From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The American Dream. Does it have a future? Hello again, I'm Armin Almy, and this is To the Point. The American Dream has been defined as an increased standard of living from generation to generation. It's when children make better pay, own more property, and enjoy life's comforts more than their parents. Now the American Dream can actually be measured. The numbers are not encouraging. The odds for children exceeding their parents' standard of living have dropped like a stone for the poor and the middle class. And the concentration of wealth in the economic stratosphere has increased by orders of magnitude. We'll hear what that means for the American Dream. On our talking point later, brutal homicides encouraged by the president of the Philippines, documented by a prize-winning war photographer. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. For the first time, it's possible to measure the American Dream, and the results are sobering, especially for the middle class. We'll hear about the failures of government and some individuals and the role of income inequality. Warren has that conversation coming up. And later on our talking point, Warren speaks with a prize-winning photographer who's covered wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the deadly toll of Ebola in Africa. He describes President Duterte's drug war in the Philippines as setting a new level of ruthlessness. And those conversations both coming up with Warren Olney. But first, this news update. President Obama is taking advantage of these last weeks of his administration to shore up his legacy on the environment. On Monday, the administration finalized a rule that holds coal companies to a strict standard of restoring land to its original condition before digging began. And Tuesday, the president announced a permanent ban on new offshore drilling in parts of the Arctic Ocean and off the Atlantic coast. But will these new protections survive in a Trump White House? Nick Giuliano is following all this. He is deputy energy editor at Politico, and it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks very much for having me, Barbara.
Well, first, Nicole, tell us more about the new rule and how long this has been in the works.
Sure. So this is what's known as the administration calls it the Stream Protection Rule. This is aimed at primarily at mountaintop coal mining that happens in Appalachian states, West Virginia and Kentucky mostly. This is something that has been in the works for more or less the entire Obama administration. It's a sort of rework of a Bush administration rule that got tied up towards the end of the Bush administration. The original rulemaking goes back to 1983, and that's the language that was updated just this week when they finally put this final rule.
So coal companies can't be happy about this. How have they responded so far?
That's correct. Coal companies are not very happy about this rule. They've been, warning for a while that it will, cost jobs in the region, cost jobs to the industry. Jobs have been on the decline in coal mining for decades due to a variety of factors, cheap natural gas, technology improvements, environmental regulations, and so on. The coal industry, their allies in Congress, have indicated immediately that they're going to go after this rule using what's called the Congressional Review Act. This is a law that was passed back in the 1990s as part of the Contract with America, and it essentially gives Congress a more or less a veto authority over recently passed regulations. It's something that has only been successfully used once before because presidents have to sign the laws once they're passed by Congress. So Obama has vetoed efforts by Congress to veto his laws before. Presumably President-elect Donald Trump will sign something like this into law if it makes it across Capitol Hill. And the key thing here is that these can't be filibustered in the Senate. So Democrats don't really have a whole lot of recourse to block this.
Well, moving on to the ban on new offshore drilling, how much area in the oceans does it protect and where exactly?
Sure. So this is the administration has announced that they're protecting 125 million acres in the Arctic Ocean, and they're protecting several canyons along the east coast in the Atlantic Ocean. But it effectively puts drilling more or less off limits in federal waters in those areas. So in the Arctic, there's still potentially some activity in state waters closer to shore, but this is a fairly wide-ranging prohibition that the administration has put into place. And the key thing here is that they're using a little tested piece of the law that allows the president to, you know, quote unquote, withdraw from dispensation areas of the what's known as the outer continental shelf. This is something that hasn't really been tested before. You know, environmentalists have been asking for the Obama administration to do this. The oil industry says that you know, they think they can reverse this in court. They can maybe get Congress to rewrite the law. That would require overcoming a filibuster in the Senate, of course. So this is going to be a fight that we're certainly going to see play out.
And how should we see this? Is it a parting effort to thwart a Trump administration on energy, or part of a bigger effort to shore up the President Obama's environmental legacy?
It could be seen both ways, and it's being sort of portrayed both ways. Certainly, the idea that Obama only has a few a month or so left in office, he's sort of racing to get done what he can get done before he gets out the door. The White House statement, for example, on the oil drilling ban that they put out, observes that it would take decades for any production to happen in these areas. And the White House says, you know, this comes at a time when we need to, you know, quote, continue to move decisively away from fossil fuels. So they clearly want to, you know, put into place as many roadblocks to further oil, gas, and coal development as they can before he leaves office.
Well, where do you think this leaves the president then as he leaves office? He was criticized early in his administration for not doing enough on the environment. And now these protections are, as I hear you say, rather fragile.
Yeah, I mean, his entire legacy is because he was thwarted in Congress in the, you know, if you go back to when we were talking about cap and trade back in 2009 and 2010, Congress didn't go along with that. He sort of shifted course and decided to say, all right, here are the laws that are in place right now. Let me do what I can do to, do as much as I can with the law as it exists right now. So he's really, critics would say stretched well beyond the original definition of things like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the, you know, Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act was the technical authority of this week's move on the offshore drilling ban. And it is, you know, it's a lot of executive authority that he's used. So presumably the next executive can undo a lot of those moves. It will take some time going through the regulatory process, but it remains to be seen how quickly that gets chipped away at.
Nick Giuliano, Deputy Energy Editor at Politico. Thanks for this.
Thanks very much.
And in a moment, Warren asks about the American dream. Does it have a future? That's on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. This program is about what's happening to the American dream and what the changes mean for the lives of real people across the country. But we have to start with a few numbers. David Leonhardt is a columnist for The New York Times. He's reported that it is now possible to actually measure the American dream. David, welcome to our program.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
What is the American dream?
Well, it has no formal definition, but it seems to first have been used in a book in 1931, and it said it's that dream of a life that is better and richer and fuller. And the author didn't actually define better and richer and fuller than what, but I think a lot of Americans have decided that a very basic meaning of it is that you live better than the generation that came before you. That is obviously a comparison that a lot of us can make. It's very salient. It's particularly salient around the holidays when we're seeing other generations. And so the idea for a lot of people has become you achieve the American dream if you live better than your parents did.
So what you've been able to report is that researchers now can measure the generations. They can follow them statistically. And there's a report about what's happened or what happened between 1940 and 1980.
That's right. There's been a real breakthrough in economic research in the last several years because following people over time is extremely difficult. It's more difficult than is often realized. You have to find the same people year after year. You have to worry that the people who fall out aren't different from the people who stay in. And a bunch of researchers have gotten access to anonymous tax records, millions of them, that let them really follow the paths of people over time. And they published a bunch of really wonderful papers. And I said to them a couple years ago, hey, you know, you could create an index of the American dream, which no one has really ever done, where you could analyze the percentage of people who out-earn their parents. And they spent a bunch of time on it and combined the tax records with census records. And they've done it, going all the way back to people who were born in 1940. And it shows that people born in 1940 were almost guaranteed to out-earn their parents, once you adjust for inflation, of course. They were almost guaranteed to have higher material living standards. More than 90% of them did, including a lot of people who, of course, didn't graduate from college, and even including some people who didn't graduate from high school. In fact, the 8% that didn't out-earn their parents overwhelmingly still ended up with good lives. They didn't out-earn their parents because their parents were quite rich. Maybe their parents were the top CEOs, and then they became a lawyer. They were still perfectly fine. They just didn't out-earn their parents. But that percentage has fallen and fallen and fallen over the last several decades.
So it was 90% in 1940. What was it in 1980?
So for people born in 1980, so these are today's 36-year-olds, it is down to 50%. 50% of people today in their 30s out-earn their parents. And I know that some people are so negative and concerned about the economy that they would say, wow, that's even higher than I would expect. And maybe it is. The thing I would remember is that over the last 30 years, the American economy has grown enormously. It has nearly doubled once you adjust for the size of the population. And so really, that percentage should be much, much higher. The reason it is not is because inequality has increased so much that a lot of people earn less than their parents, even though the economy is so much larger and more productive than it was in their parents' day and age.
How is that reflected in our politics?
Well, I mean, I think with Donald Trump, you have a candidate who has managed to tap into a lot of the concern about the fading American dream very effectively. I mean, if you look at the states where he effectively won the election, the ones he flipped in the Midwest, those are states that used to be better than the nation as a whole economically and are now worse than the nation as a whole. What is worrisome to me is that while politically he did a very good job of tapping into that concern, there is very little evidence that he is pursuing a set of policies that are actually going to reignite the American dream. I'm happy to say, look, we need to wait till he actually takes office and begins proposing actual policies. But based on his proposals, there is a lot of reason for concern.
David Leonhardt with the New York Times won a Pulitzer Prize for his economics commentary. Jonah Ivan lives in a trailer in Wichita, Kansas. She describes herself as a poor white working class woman. She also is an eloquent writer. She's written a memoir called Will Love for Crimes. In April, she wrote an article for Stir. That's her online journal, and it was called I Know Why Poor Whites Chant Trump, Trump, Trump. Jonah Ivan, welcome to you.
Hi, well, thank you for having me.
Why do they do that?
Well, in the article, I went back and I sort of traced how the wealthy elite have sort of manipulated and used poor working whites to kind of vote against their own best interests. And I think we saw this again in Trump's election, that he was speaking to them in terms of bringing jobs back. I personally don't believe that that's true, that that's what he's going to do. But he spoke to them in that way, and that is what I think a lot of poor and working class whites are focused on. They do sort of have this idea that they want to go back to having a better life economically, and he spoke to that, whereas I think maybe the Democrats really didn't speak to that. You know, they didn't really lay out a plan that seemed feasible to these working class people. There was talk of raising the minimum wage when Bernie Sanders was in the race, and then that kind of, it was still, we're going to raise it, but not as much. These sorts of things, they kind of petered off. And I think I think that the white working class and poor people were sort of lied to and bamboozled and manipulated once again into following along with their wealthy counterparts to hope that that dream will somehow trickle down to them. I don't think it will.
You talked about how the wealth. I want to ask you a question. You talked about how the wealthy elite have manipulated these people. You also have some remarkable anecdotes about the people you are talking about and the kinds of resentments they have, which don't seem to be aimed necessarily at the upper class.
Yes, and I think that that's and I think there's been a very specific way that the anger of the poor and working class whites has been misdirected. And we saw this in Reagan's time when he sort of trotted out the welfare queen. And there was this image as if black and brown people who are collecting public assistance are criminals, you know? And so we put this out into the world, and then white people who are maybe also benefiting from public assistance see this separateness. They're saying, well, I'm working towards getting back on my feet, and yes, I'm collecting public assistance, but the welfare queens, which was completely fictional, right? Those people, they're just using the system and they're getting a free ride. And this is a way that the media is a lot of times dividing poor people and pitting them against each other when really they have more common problems and their way of life is more similar.
Describe your own background, your family expectations when you were growing up. You were from California. Now you're in Wichita, Kansas. What are you doing there?
I am in Wichita, mm-hmm. Kansas. I want to clarify, you said I was living in a trailer in Wichita. I am not. I lived in a trailer when I was in Arkansas, but now I'm in Wichita. So I'm not in a trailer at the moment.
Okay.
Although I love that trailer. But regardless, I grew up with a single working mother. She got an entry-level position with the Pacific Telephone Company when that was around. And she stayed there, and she just worked and worked and worked, and she built herself up to probably a lower middle class. Then she lost her job with that company, and she filed bankruptcy at one time, and so became a renter instead of a homeowner, you know. But there were never really high expectations in my family that we weren't sort of pushed to go to college. My mother just sort of knew how to be a working class person, you know. So when I graduated from high school, I had the intention of going to college, but that was the same year that my mother lost her job. So when I applied, they told me that I couldn't. She had made too much money for me to get financial aid, even though that job she no longer had. So I didn't know. I didn't know how the system worked. I didn't understand how getting loans and filing for financial aid worked. So I just went out and got a job, and I kept having jobs and staying in low-end, low-working jobs.
You were a waitress particularly?
I was a waitress for many years. I was a bartender. I've had entry-level office positions. I managed a retail store, these different jobs that I've gotten. But I've never built a resume that ever sort of propelled me into the upper classes.
So why do you think that is? Why didn't you try to do better?
Well, I don't know if it was necessarily a lack of trying to do better. I didn't do the typical route, which is go and work for a company, stay with that company, stay with them for 20, 30, 40 years, and at the end you get a retirement. I didn't do that. I bounced around. And I think possibly part of that is my creative endeavors. I would do these creative projects. Part of it's my personality. I don't have a personality that can stay working for one company, for a long time and just kind of keep grinding that out.
But the people you write about, and excuse me for interrupting you, the people you write about, and I know why poor whites chant Trump, are people that you go out of your way to say and portray as people who really are victimized.
Well, I don't necessarily, I hope that I don't point them out as being victims, but I do think that they have bought into this ideal of the American dream that's kind of given, you know, that's the ideal way to live, and that that's something that is inherently owed to them in a lot of ways. And I'll say it because of their whiteness, because I think that's where the American dream comes out of. I don't think when they first brought out the idea of the American dream that that necessarily applied to black and brown people. I think it's an ideal that white America holds, and they're seeing that being slipping away, and they're angry about it.
Okay. Again, Jonah Ivan has her own website. It's called Stir. And we'll get back to her as well as David Leonhardt in a moment. But first, I want to introduce David French, who's a former major in the U.S. Army, a staff writer for the Conservative National Review, senior fellow with the National Review Institute. And he has written that the American dream is dying because of what he calls a broken culture. David French, welcome.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that unlike periods of poverty in the past, what we have seen in the United States in the last several decades is an escalating amount of family disillusion. In other words, the intact family, the mother-father family where the kids go to school and finish their education, is becoming more and more the province of the upper middle class in this country. And even going into the middle class, there's increasing amounts of illegitimacy, for example, decreasing marriage rates. And then when you go into the ranks of the poor and the working class, the percentages are very, very high. Very high even in the, you know, even in white populations that had previously been immune to these trends. And so what's happening is this family disillusion and the rise of single parenting is creating a level of instability. It's creating family complexities and degrees of trauma even in kids. Robert Putnam outlines this very well in his groundbreaking book, Our Kids, where these families are increasingly ill-equipped to take advantage of economic opportunity, increasingly hamstrung by the family situation. For example, two households are much more expensive to maintain than one household. One income is harder to raise a family on than two incomes. And so what we're having is an increasing number of people who are just less well equipped to take advantage of economic opportunity. And they have wounds that public policy can't heal. And so they're looking to, say, a Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is saying, I alone can fix this. And he can't fix this. There's a cultural issue that's beyond the reach of any president. And I would note there's kind of an irony here, because I remember when I came home from Iraq in 2008 and I was catching up on politics, I saw an awful lot of people forwarding around videos of Obama supporters who were saying in no uncertain terms that Obama, for example, would make it easier to pay their mortgage. And they were laughing. And then you saw the GOP. Many people in the GOP turned around and kind of did the same thing about Donald Trump, and believed this "I alone can fix this" rhetoric that he just cannot possibly deliver on it.
Okay, let me ask you to hold off, if you will, for a moment, because we need to go to a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more with David French and Jonah Ivan and David Leonhardt. And David French, I want to ask you this question: do you think that what you have just described is a cause or a consequence of the inequality that we heard about earlier from David Leonhardt? We'll be back in a moment on today's Talking Point: brutal homicides encouraged by the president of the Philippines, documented by a prize-winning war photographer. We'll talk about those on To the Point from Public Radio International. We're only back with To the Point, talking today about the American dream, defined as an increased standard of living from generation to generation. And we've heard now that statistics show that people born in 1940 had a 90% chance of achieving the American dream, as defined that way. The people born in 1980, who are 36 today, have only a 50% chance of doing that. Back to David French with the National Review. Once again, the question I asked at the end of the last half hour, is this due to moral decline, to cultural change, to the sorts of dissolution of the family that you described? Or are those things all symbolic or excuse me, symptomatic of the income inequality that has also occurred in those years?
Well, you know, I think the reasons for income inequality are many and varied. But to the extent that whether this family dissolution is a cause or consequence, I would say more cause than consequence. And one of the reasons why I say this is that when a person or a family does get married, stay married, complete their education, there is real economic opportunity in the U.S., and these families tend to do much better. The families who are falling behind are the families, and there are, of course, exceptions. There are exceptions. There are people who rise out of single-parent families or in the middle of single-parent families who do very, very well. But as a generality, there's a much, much higher poverty rate. There's much higher rates of all kinds of dysfunction. And so it's much more difficult to elevate from that position. And one of the things that I keep going back to this point, but this I think it's very, very important, because when we're talking about kids who grow up in that environment, there are stressors, there are sources of trauma that occur in the context of family dissolution that often have lifelong consequences. And so it's very difficult or more difficult than if you are raised in an intact home to rise above these challenges and to elevate yourself economically. So I'm not going to say that family dissolution is the cause of income inequality in this country, because it's not. And I think it's obvious that there are other factors in play, among them, you know, a global economy that presents an enormous number of challenges to our own. But it is more cause than consequence.
David Leonhardt, back to you with the New York Times. Is there research that would confirm or not what we've just heard from David French?
I agree with David that this, it is. I might put it slightly differently, but I broadly agree, which is I think it is both cause and consequence. There's a lot of research on the question. There's no research that definitively answers it. I know there are people out there who argue that it is only a consequence, which is to say that all of the dissolution of families is about declining economic prospects. I disagree with that. I think, as David does, that the breakup of families, the rise in single-parent families, is also a cause of inequality. And if you look at how the story has happened chronologically, the data doesn't quite fit the notion that it all comes from the economics, because the rise in single-parent families began, to some extent, before some of the inequality rise happened. Having said that, I also think it's really clear that this isn't the only cause. We also see difficulty rising among kids who have grown up in two-parent families. We also see a lot of these trends affecting two-parent families. And so if you were going to think about a big solution to this American dream problem, I think you would want to think about how to try to encourage more intact families. I think that's extremely difficult, and I don't think we know exactly how to do it. But you wouldn't want to stop there. You would also want to think about improving educational prospects for low- and middle-income kids. You'd want to think about a tax system that didn't give its biggest tax breaks to people who are earning the most. You would want to think about how to make sure, how to address the fact that corporate profits have risen much more rapidly than wages. So I think it's a really complicated and difficult story.
Let me go back to John Ivan again, author of I Know Why Poor Whites Chant Trump, 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 and also Will Love for Crumbs, a book that she has written, one of three. Once again, she describes herself as a poor white working woman. How do you see our other what we've heard from our other guests? And do you think that there has been a decline because of instability in families? You yourself came from a single-parent family. Do you think there's something the government could do about it?
Well, no. I mean, I would have to disagree that for me, when I hear that, you know, instabilities in families can lead to poverty, I hear that that's some sort of moral failing on poor people. and that's some sort of, it feels like finger pointing as to why people are poor, you know. And we have a president-elect right now who's working on his third baby mama, so that didn't seem to hurt him, and I don't think it hurts many wealthy people. So I don't like the idea of putting these two things together, economics and sort of morality and moral failings. Certainly, yes, if you look at the numbers, if you have two incomes coming into a household, you are going to be financially better off. I mean, that's just math. But when we sort of encourage people to stay together and keep a family unit together, sometimes I think that's a bit of a dangerous message, because we know of a lot of battered and abused women who are in poor economic conditions and are having a really hard time getting out of that. And so to encourage them to stay, I think, is a little bit scary.
David, you know? French, back to you. Are you suggesting a moral failing on the part of the poor? And what about situations such as we just heard described, when a broken family might be better than one that stays together?
Yeah, I don't think any sensible person would say that people are getting physically abused and beaten in physically dangerous situations should stay in that situation for the sake of economics. I mean, that's not the message at all. But what we are seeing are a number of decisions that people are making on how to live their lives that are destructive. And, you know, look, I would say many of those decisions are immoral. And if you don't want to use the language of morality, they are destructive and they are harmful to the prospects of their children. But, you know, it is a good point to say that these prospects and these harmful decisions, the consequences don't fall equally on everyone. Of course, if you're Donald Trump and you're starting off with a cushion of a few hundred million dollars, you're the downward path. If you can go through as many baby mamas as you want and you're going to retain your wealth, or at least to the extent you don't divide it with these other wives. But, you know, the fact of the matter is most people are not a Donald Trump. And when you begin to divide incomes and when you begin to divide household expenses or multiply household expenses, I should say, with multiple households and multiple child support payments, then, you know, one of the sad things about that is you come in and new jobs with even a pretty decent raise or a marginally decent raise doesn't significantly improve your prospects because of the division of the dollar, because of the multiplying expenses. And I don't think I think it's empowering to tell people that they can make different choices that will improve their prospects. And of course, the flip side of that is if you make other choices, those will be more destructive. And that's not the only answer. I want to be very, very clear. There are economic factors in play. We can and should do much better in our education system. I think that is a key fault line that we have to work on. And then there are challenges from the global economy that we have to think long and hard about, but that to allow our citizens to facilitate our citizens as we effort to overcome them. For example, I don't think, for example, that Donald Trump's punitive approach in trade is appropriate or helpful. But we do need to be thinking hard about the impact of trade on our economy and doing what we can to ameliorate its worst effects.
Jonah Ivan, let me go back to you and talk about politics again and a different kind of division that you describe, which is the division amongst people who are all pretty much in the same boat. Tell us about the people at the Tyson Chicken Plant, for example, who were in deep trouble but didn't blame the Tyson Chicken Company for their problems. They blame somebody else.
Yeah, I do. I wrote about that in the essay, and it puzzled me when I was bartending in Arkansas, and there were a lot of people out of work, and they would talk about Tyson Chicken, and they would talk about that they couldn't get jobs there. White people couldn't get jobs there because they only hired immigrants, and you had to speak Spanish in order to work there. And my feeling was, well, why are you angry at other poor people who are just trying to get jobs. Why are you not angry at Tyson Chicken? They're the ones who are going to hire the person that they can pay the least and then keep everybody kind of in poverty. And a lot of times what I heard was that Don Tyson was sort of one of them. He was kind of a good old boy. He used to go around and say, oh, I'm just a chicken farmer, which is laughable. I mean, the man was running a multi-billion dollar company. He wasn't just a chicken farmer. But they liked that about him. He was sort of one of them. And again, it was this kind of misdirection of anger in blaming immigrants for their situation instead of blaming Walmart, Tyson Chicken, you know, the main employers of that area for paying such a low wage and keeping everybody in poverty.
David Leonhardt, back to you. You mentioned corporate profits very high early on. To what extent is it, do you think, a good idea for government to think about a redistribution of those profits into the workforce? Would that, in fact, be a way that government could help ease this situation?
I think if you look at what's happened broadly over the last 35 years, what we've had is we've had very big increases in income at the top, including big increases in corporate profits, which people made fun of Mitt Romney for saying corporations are people. But he actually had a point, which is at the end of the day, corporations are owned by people. And so corporate profits go to people, and they tend to go to affluent people because that's who owns the bulk of the stock. And so through corporate profits, through income, through all these ways, we have had really enormous wage and income gains at the top. We have also had, over the last 50 years, the biggest tax cuts at the top. And to me, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you because we're going to lose David French in just a moment. I want to get him to respond to this. What about it? Is there something there that the government can do through regulation that might, in fact, ease this situation?
Well, you know, I would say that what the government can do here is quite limited, except to the extent that it can stop doing affirmatively harmful things. And I think that one of the affirmatively harmful things that is causing economic stagnation and loss and really loss of ground in the middle class and the working class in the United States is we just have, especially in working class communities, terrible public education. It's just I live in a community in rural Tennessee, and we have a lot of teachers who are doing the best that they possibly can. But the education system is not really functioning well for our kids here.
But wouldn't it be more direct if you went to the corporations, taxed them at a higher rate, and required them to and either have the government redistribute the money in some way other than just handouts, or encourage them somehow to split the profits with the workers?
Well, it doesn't work quite like that, because once you begin to tax more extensively, and in the United States, that's one of the higher corporate tax rates in the world, you begin to adjust economic incentives in a lot of ways. For example, we have corporations who park an awful lot of money overseas because of the size of our corporate tax rate. When you begin to adjust corporate individual taxes to much higher rates in the higher income tax brackets, you begin to adjust incentives towards work.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but what I'm hearing you saying, and I'm trying to get you out of the program because I know you need to leave, you're suggesting that we really need a long-term solution, and education is one important element of it.
Right, absolutely. We can't just simply say, okay, we're going to increase the corporate tax rate to 40%, or we're going to increase the upper marginal income tax rate for the wealthiest Americans to 60%. Well, where's that money going? How is that going to adjust the incentives of someone to work at that 60% tax rate? Because remember, we have tried in the past tax rates even as high as, you know, closer to 80, 90% at the very highest tax income brackets. And that didn't really work then.
David French again with the National Review, the National Review Institute. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Jonah Ivan, what would you like to see happen? What do you think would improve the situation of the people that you describe in your story?
Well, I think first and foremost, we absolutely have to raise the minimum wage. I mean, it's the idea that housing has gone up so expensive. It's gotten so high, and the wages are so low that people now are having to sometimes two and three of their paychecks are going just to keep a roof over their head. And I don't believe it when corporations say, oh, it will, put us out of business. It might cut into their profits, but when you're talking about billions of dollars of profits, I think they can afford to take a little less profit.
Okay, David Leonard, just quickly, if you will, is the raising the minimum wage a good idea?
Yes, I think it is. I would be wary of doing it across the board and saying it should be $15 in New York City the same way it should be in a small upstate New York town. So I would prefer a regionally variable minimum wage. But yes, I think we should raise the minimum wage. And most voters clearly agree with me because nearly every time it goes on the ballot, it's a raise and the minimum wage is approved, whether it's in a blue state or a red state.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much for being with us. Once again, David Leonard, columnist for The New York Times, Jonna Ivan, author of Will Love for Crumbs, and a recent article on her online journal, Stir, I Know Why Poor Whites Chant Trump, 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 and our earlier guest, David French, with The National Review. Great to have you all, and to come back and talk to us again about the situation of Americans as the American dream seems to be fading away. A new level of ruthlessness encouraged and sanctioned by the president of the Philippines. We'll hear about that in a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Alney here with today's Talking Point. Since Rodrigo Duterte was elected president of the Philippines this summer, some 6,000 people have been gunned down in the streets, 2,000 by the police, 4,000 by unknown suspects. It's all part of Duterte's war on drugs, and he has boasted that he has killed people himself from the back of a motorcycle to challenge officers. If I can do it, why can't you? Daniel Bereluk is a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer for The New York Times. He's documented 57 of these killings with his camera, and he's talked to people in and around the neighborhoods. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Warren.
You can compare this to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and to other horrors that you have seen around the world. How would you rank it?
What I saw in Philippines was a new level of ruthlessness. Something that was so one-sided in a so-called war, and something that seemed like mass state-sanctioned killings perpetrated by the Philippines National Police. And to see it perpetrated and hearing the stories of killings happening and seeing them with my own eyes night after night over 35 days in Manila was extremely alarming.
One picture, a very graphic picture, as they all are, blood on the floor of a family living room where 34-year-old Fleur John Cruz was killed. Statue of the Virgin Mary looking down from a shelf. Tell us about that situation.
That was a crime scene that we attended. And the story that the family told us was that Fleur John was home fixing his mother's, 71-year-old mother's transistor radio when police burst in and ordered his mother out, and within 2-3 minutes, he was killed. The police called it a drug buy bust operation, and according to witnesses, according to family, Fleur John had stopped using drugs for a number of months since July, and it was a completely different story that they told us. He was targeted. There was a gun that was placed on his person and also drugs found on his body.
Erica Angel Fernandez, discarded on a trash pile of old mattresses, a 17-year-old girl, one of three of the women that you photographed.
Erica was killed in a vigilante-style killing alongside her 21-year-old boyfriend. What was interesting about this case was there was a local Filipino journalist who further researched this story and found out that it may not have been connected to drugs. So what is interesting is that with this climate of killing that this is an opportunity, and it was a lover's tiff, but this was an opportunity, and allows opportunities for other people to kill during this time.
One of the things that you document very movingly in your photographs is what this means to the families of people. There's an image of three children in an alleyway, lit candles there, capturing that family grieving the death of Joselito Rufino. Tell us about him. He was killed in an alley.
Joselito Rufino, that's another case where the police came across 15 masked men and one lady. They come across, they came across from the direction of the police station in the guise, completely disguised in vigilante style. None of the identities shown. They then grabbed Joselito, handcuffed him, told everyone to go back inside, and dragged him down an alleyway. They then, the lady, police officer, yelled out "Nun Laban," which means in Filipino that they're fighting out, they're resisting arrest. And they shot Joselito dead in the alleyway. And once again, they call it a by-bust operation. If it is a by-bust operation, they're certainly acting like vigilantes and not at all coming across as police.
Do most of these incidents occur in poor and deprived neighborhoods of the Philippines?
They have been. Over 90% of the neighborhoods that we visited, the crime scenes were in the poorest of neighborhoods. These people have no voices, and they feel like they have no rights as well, and no one's listening to them, and therefore seem easy targets in order to get the body count up.
You talked to police officers about this, and some of them, as I take it, joked about it.
They did. There was one particular officer, Redento, who was a police chief, police station one, during a briefing before we went out, actually joked about that there was a new way of dying in the Philippines, and it was Nun Laban. And he motioned with his hands clasped together as if they were handcuffed, as if some kind of, dark joke. And laughed and chuckled about it.
Did you take a picture of that?
We didn't, because it took a little while for the translation to come through, and it was only afterwards I realized the importance of his words.
But you did show pictures of handcuffs.
No, absolutely. There were many handcuffs, many photographs of the victims that were killed while they were wearing handcuffs. And one evening in particular, we were waiting outside that specific police station, and we were told that there was a by-bust, or there was an operation that was happening, and they kept 15 or 20 of the media there. And then within a few minutes, there's CCTV footage showing Benjamin Vista being loaded onto the back of a motorbike. That was at 11:52 p.m., At 12:13 or 12:15, 17 minutes later, I photographed Benjamin Vista handcuffed and shot dead by police. Once again, as they were transporting him, they said that he resisted arrest, and they shot him dead in literally in front of us, about 50 meters away from the police station.
This is after you saw him being put on the motorcycle.
This was only later that we understood that there was CCTV footage, and then kind of linked it all together. And it was only like probably a week or two later that we realized that once we were able to get the CCTV footage, that it was Benjamin that was being loaded. And until we asked, going into the communities and asking family of how it happened, that the larger story came out.
Why were some of the heads of the bodies wrapped in plastic tape?
It's a sick way of killing some of these, alleged drug personalities. What they would do is they would put a plastic bag over their head and suffocate them, and tape the bag onto their heads in a very grotesque way, and tie their hands behind their backs with packing tape as well, so they couldn't resist. And they would die in either being suffocated or through a puncture wound in their chest, and their bodies dumped by the side of the road. And a sign putting, usually accompanied with a sign around their neck, warning others that this could be them, saying, "I'm a pusher. Don't let this be you."
And some of the people that you have photographed, dead people, murdered in the sort of ways that we've heard described, are people who actually have already surrendered to the government, given their names, and said that they'd either stopped using drugs or that they were doing everything they could to stop using drugs.
That's correct. That's correct. There was a drug, so-called drug rehabilitation program that the president announced, and some 700,000 users surrendered in July and August, believing that they would receive some kind of amnesty and a road to rehabilitation. And it is these people also that were being targeted, not only the users and not only the pushers.
And the president is encouraging this, obviously, and saying that he took part himself.
Absolutely. I mean, His rhetoric is nothing new. This is the first time that he's admitted to doing it himself. But while we were there, the count went over 4,000, and he gladly said that he would kill 20 or 30,000 more, or he would triple it if needed to. He's never been shy of stating the fact that he's wanted to slaughter millions of drug users.
Daniel Baralek, once again, a photographer, prize-winning photographer, war photographer for the New York Times, telling us about what's going on the streets of the Philippines. Thank you so much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren. Thank you.
I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
International.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.